Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for calling the official hotline of www.gerweck.net. That's your host on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news. I'm your host, Michael T., and for all those calling in for Michael T. Mondays and the Monday Night Raw recap, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen tonight, but there is just cause. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct pleasure to bring to you a former WWF European champion, former WWF tag team champion, and former six-time WWF hardcore champion. He's the trainer at OVW, and he's here with us tonight. He's Al Snow.
Hello there, and I have to correct you. I'm not the former European champion. I was the former Europeanist champion.
Well then, I'm sorry. My bad. And weren't you credited as being the longest reigning American-born European champion? Was that the gimmick that they had going for you?
Actually, I had decided, since I was the Europeanist champion, to represent all of the Europeanist countries, and I would come out and dress and act and speak in their language and carry, things, wholesome things that represented the countries in their particular tastes and flavors.
Is there any that you felt you connected with more so than others?
Oh, gosh, I would say Transylvania.
Transylvania, hooked up with that.
I came out with a box of Count Chocula and, a picture of Eddie Munster. And the electric bat that was flapping around my head and dressed up as Count Dracula. I think that really put people in touch.
Now, I seem to recall you walking around with a lot of sausage links around you, too, or Brad Worcester.
Yeah, I think that was Germany.
Germany, yes.
That was Germany. And, I had actually suggested that, because I was wearing lederhosen at the time, that I'd be allowed to have the sausage links taking out the fly of the lederhosen. But, I wasn't allowed to do that on TV, unfortunately.
Shawn Michaels can put socks in his pants, but you can't have sausage hanging out of your lederhosen.
No, can't do it.
It's all right, but you know what? You're a respectable Europeanist champion, and there's no doubt about it.
Oh, absolutely. I have nothing but respect for our Europeanist neighbors.
Well, we have to respect them, and since then, they vacated the title as they can't come up with anything better than you. So
true.
So, once you get to the best, what's the point?
I've taken it to the pinnacle.
Yeah, I've taken it there. There's no doubt about it. Well, Al, tonight, I really got to thank you. We're going to talk about a lot of different things tonight. Whatever's on your mind, and a lot of callers and a lot of fans have a lot of things to ask you, including Tough Enough.
I can tell you one of the things that's on my mind, and that is that a couple days ago, I had thought that I didn't have to do anything, and I was starting to come down with a cold, so I took some NyQuil. Then I realized I had to be down here in OVW, so I took some DayQuil, figuring they'd kind of even each other out, and I'd have, like, afternoon quill. But all I did was go outside and contemplate the meaning of the sidewalk the rest of the day. So,
it doesn't matter, really. I mean, you got NyQuil and you got DayQuil. I mean, your cold doesn't matter what time of day it is, does it?
I didn't think so, but apparently it does. NyQuil's like the crack of cold medicine, so.
Well, it's the hard stuff. It's actually got alcohol, not like that Robitussin crap, right?
Right, that's why we love it.
as one comic likes to say, if you're going to be sick, you might as well enjoy it, right?
Exactly.
Well, you've been a very busy guy down there in OVW.
Actually, I have been. I'm in the process of trying to relocate here. So if anybody's interested in a really beautiful house in the Dayton, Ohio area, just outside the inner Dayton International Airport, 6 minutes away, please let me know. I'm selling my home, so... And I'm, taking offers. But since I have yet to do that, I've been required to commute back and forth each week. And it's been very enjoyable being down here. I'm very proud of all the talent that are down here. They're really some exceptional people. And I think really bright young stars. And, it's been phenomenal. Paulie has taken over the writing duties of the TV. And I honestly can say that I think, in a lot of ways, it's becoming its own new ECW, but better and different from ECW.
What's it like working with Paulie again?
It's very good. I mean, Paulie's been very good, but at the same time, it can be very frustrating because Paulie's Paulie. So, and that being said, I mean it's. It's not an impeachment upon Paulie. Paulie is Paulie, but he is, he's the evil genius. I mean, he's really, really good. And, but for all his, genius in being able to write TV and it be compelling and all that. You need the talent to be able to step up and carry through with what he's wanting to do. And so it's a very synergistic effort down here between myself and what I'm trying to train these guys to do. And then Paulie writing the TV in a manner that gives them the experience to do it, carry it out, and then Danny Davis, God love him. I mean, that man is like a machine. I don't know when he sleeps, if he ever does, because, you know, he literally sits there and edits the TV and puts it together, coming up with B-roll and et cetera to help Paulie tell his particular story until, you know, 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. He'll take his girlfriend Julie home and then come right back, and I'll see him when I come in at 9 o'clock. And he won't go home and get some sleep until around 10:30 or so every Wednesday.
Well, you know, one thing that a lot of the trainers do know, and they have an eye for talent, a lot of talented people come through OVW. In fact, current world champion John Cena and current other world champion on the SmackDown side, Batista, all came through OVW.
Yeah.
Insider scoop, Al, who are you seeing as the next future superstar of the WWE?
Well, they just recently called up Ken Kennedy, Ken Anderson down here, and I think he's an incredible, you know, he's been a really great talent and has a ton of potential. And, boy, I would have to say after him, Aaron Stevens, let me think here, Matt Capitelli, of course, you know, they were brought up not too long ago, Eminem, gosh, Paul Burchill. I see a lot in Jimmy Snuka Jr., Tank and Chad Tolan, on the tag team side, Beth Phoenix and Shelly Mayo, girls.
You know, that actually brings an interesting question, Al, is that a lot of the times, a lot of fans are kind of registering their voices that the tag team division on both the SmackDown and Raw side are pretty much void at this point. Is there a lot of OVW talent that's ready to spice up the tag team division?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Tolans would be really good. I know that they, you know, they brought up the Heartbreakers and made them the Heartthrobs not too long ago for Raw. They brought up Eminem for SmackDown, and I think that they speak for themselves. So I think there's some, you know, definite potential. I think that the reason that, you know, the tag team division up there has just not been the focus or the desire for some time. You know, Vince always has looked at the tag team division as kind of a sideshow thing. His true heart lies more with the singles division. But, boy, when the tag division gets hot, you know, it'll really draw money. I mean, back when Edge and Christian and the Hardys and the Dudleys were rolling, I mean, it was really good. So I think it's coming up to where, you know, they'll have enough teams in the mix to where they can really get it rolling again here very soon.
Now, one of the latest things to break right now is that it was officially announced today on WWE.com that Daniel Puter has been released from the WWE. He had a one-year guaranteed contract with a three-year option. After the 1 year, WWE has decided not to give that option. I'm looking for your feelings on that.
Well, you know, it's pretty tough. Daniel was in a very tough spot. I mean, I told all of the guys who were competing in the $1 million Tough Enough Challenge that, you know, winning tough enough and basically winning the $1 million could be a boon or it could be a curse. You know, you could have a year or a career. And the likelihood is you're going to have a year because it's just not realistic to believe that you can live up to $1 million worth of expectation. You know, this business is about one thing and one thing only, and that's drawing money, selling tickets, and setting the bar that high with a guy. You know, basically you're investing $1 million in the guy before he even draws you one dime. It's kind of hard on the guy. There's no way that he could ever perform at that $1 million level, considering that he's never done it before in his life, has no experience whatsoever, and regardless of what anybody says, this is a true absolute art form. And since it is an absolute art form, it requires a lot of skill and training and experience to perform it well and perform it on a level that will allow you to draw the money that you need to draw. So putting somebody, setting somebody up at $1 million level with that kind of idea in mind, with their lack of experience and skill, it's just, there's just no way they could do it.
Now, I got to ask you, what was your initial reaction when you saw how well Daniel Puter did in the ring with Kurt Angle during that shoot challenge?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't understand is that luck favored Dan, and I'm not trying to belittle what Daniel did with Kurt Angle, and I'm not trying to protect Kurt Angle. Daniel Puter's a very tough guy. He knows his stuff. But what a lot of people fail to realize is that Kurt Angle has, you know, neck injuries and has a lot of problems, you know, from where he broke his neck and won the gold medal. He was out there and had wrestled a couple of other guys ahead of time, and when he was wrestling them, he had jammed his neck and pinched a nerve, where he had absolutely no feeling in both his hands, in both his arms. So that makes it pretty easy for Daniel Puter to put a key lock on the guy when, you know, the guy doesn't really have sufficient strength due to, you know, nerve problems from the neck injury.
Now, one of the things that's going around right now about this $1 million challenge was that it was for $250,000 every year. Is that true, or does he get the full million?
No, it was $250,000 a year for 4 years.
So he's getting the $250,000 for this first year, and now from what's being speculated at this point, he will be offered a substantially lower contract with OVW to continue his developmental deals?
He was offered a developmental contract, the normal developmental contract, to continue on with Deep South Wrestling.
With Deep South?
Yeah, they were going to transfer him down to Deep South.
And how is that development going at this point as far as Deep South opening up?
You know, reports I've heard that things are coming along very well. You know, of course they're not going to be quite up to the speed that, you know, OVW is, because it's been in existence a lot longer with a lot more experience, you know, with Danny Davis running it and so on. You know, it's just been around longer and has more of an established momentum and routine. But I think, from what I understand, everybody's real happy with how things have been progressing.
Now, I have to ask you, I mean, you've been thrown into this position at OVW at the expense of one Jim Cornette. He was formerly in charge, and now he's not. Do you feel that you have a lot of big shoes to fill in at this current situation?
Well, that's a mistake, because I wasn't thrown in at the expense of Jim Cornette. If Jim Cornette would have still been here, I would have still been doing my same exact position. Cornette was never in charge of training the guys. You know, Lance Storm and my, you know, when Lance Storm and Bill DeMott shared those duties for quite some time, basically tagging in and out. And then, you know, I came in and Lance was offered made an offer to, and he declined it, deciding on opening his own school, which, you know, I was going to be the head of OVW, and then he was going to be here to assist with me and assist with Bill DeMott in Deep South. And he declined it. So whether Jimmy was here or not, it would not have changed my responsibilities or duties. And it wouldn't have changed Jimmy's either. Jimmy would have still been a commentator and would have still been in charge of writing the TV.
Is there any chance of Jimmy coming back?
You know, never say never. I mean, you know this with this business, but I find that highly unlikely. Not in the near future anyways, I can't imagine it.
Now, one of the hottest topics right now has got to be NWA TNA, and as they call Black Wednesday, when the WWE released a substantial amount of wrestlers, there's a lot of talk of them showing up in TNA. Do you think that's going to be a smart move, or do you think it's a possible move for a lot of these guys that were released?
Well, of course. I think that it's the most direct and obvious choice to make a living. So, of course, they're going to go there. And I think it'll help to, in some ways, the right guys be going there, much like WCW back in the day, help substantiate WCW as a force and a competitor, will help to substantiate possibly NWA TNA.
And so do you think that this move to Spike TV could gear things up for the WWE, maybe incite some competition, as it were?
I hope so. I hope for WWE's sake, and I hope for TNA's sake, and I hope for the wrestling business as a whole's sake, and I certainly hope for the fans' sake that it does.
What's your general feeling of the product today?
In what way?
Just general consensus. I mean, the talent, the ratings, the whole presentation. Do you feel that? I know, like back in 97, 98, there was so much thrown at the then WWF for being smutty and this and that. But now it's more. Is it geared towards family now, or do you feel it's trying to hit a different audience? What's your take on the product? What direction is it going?
You know, that's hard to say because. You can't. It's like comparing apples and oranges. And the reason why I say that, and it's not a cop-out answer, you're asking me to compare now to 5 years ago. Well, 5 years ago was a completely different audience. Now it's a completely different audience now. You know, that's the thing. Everybody always says, oh, well, you know, wrestling's scripted. Well, you can't script it because every night's a different night, and every night's a different audience. And so you can't possibly script everything. You got to go with the audience. Wrestling has been and always will be a reflection of its audience. And, you know, I think it's going through a transition and trying to find itself right now, trying to find the connection with the audience again, which it does. It goes through periods like it always has. But, you know, to say that it's less than or you know, better than, you can't because each... Every cycle, it's completely different, and it adjusts.
Let's talk about the move from Spike TV to USA Network. Do you feel that this is going to give it that burst, perhaps, that it was looking for? I mean, they've got a pretty stellar show lined up for October 3rd. It's, I mean, a three-hour broadcast with Hulk Hogan, Mick Foley. I'm pretty sure you know Mick Foley. Stone Cold Steve Austin. They're really hyping the show, the return of Triple H. Do you think maybe this could attract a different audience that they're looking for?
It's hard telling. I really don't know enough information to really give a quantifiable answer in regards to, you know, giving an opinion in regards to the show on USA Network. I know that USA is opening up, you know, obviously Vince is a very smart businessman and has taken he's willing to take a couple steps backward to take, you know, large steps forward. And I know that he's excited about the opportunities with USA. I think that it has more exposure nationally, I believe, than Spike TV does on the cable, which will allow him to, you know, access more of a broader audience. And I think there was something in the deal because USA is owned by NBC, I think now.
Yes, I believe it is.
Where they, you know, Vince will get Saturday Night Main Events again, which you know should help to propel, you know. The product into a new audience also.
Now, one of your former duties included being an announcer on Sunday Night Heat. And now with this acquisition or move to USA Network, subsidiary shows like Velocity and Sunday Night Heat will be removed from the programming. How do you think this affects a lot of the guys on the roster that, you know, were mainstays there?
Well, I think it's going to make it even more competitive for these guys to, you know, find a spot on the show. And find a spot, a useful spot, with the promotion. Because, you know, before they had a vehicle of promotion if they weren't on Raw, and that was Sunday Night Heat or Velocity. And with those gone, the only vehicle for promotion of themselves and opportunity to get themselves over is on Raw and on SmackDown. And let's face it, there's only going to be a limited number of spots there because they've only got so much time. If they have a half an hour, they'll only get actually 19 minutes of time per half hour for these guys to be put out on TV. So everybody's going to be even that much more competitive and that much more aggressive. And, you know, and with the business the way it is and with WWE now being a publicly traded company and them looking at just the bottom line and being willing to, you know, cut guys in a heartbeat, it's going to get rough.
For some time now, it's been speculated that the brand split is to blame, but then again, it's been defended that the brand split is giving more exposure to the workers, a lot of different guys.
Absolutely.
And I guess you echo the same sentiments?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. And I think that, you know, the brand split's not to blame. I mean, it's just, the wrestling business has always gone up and then cycled down, even when it was back in the territory days. It just wasn't as obvious because when Tennessee got really hot and, you know, the Carolinas cooled off, you know, you didn't realize the Carolinas cooled off at a national level because it wasn't on a national level. It was just, you know, it was just territorial. So one territory got hot, one cooled off, another got hot, another cooled off. Guys would just, talent would make their way around so they could continue to make money. And, but now there's, you know, one national or basically international territory. And when it cools off, everybody knows it.
And this is the time for those competitors, such as, let's say, TNA, to really try to spark a fire up and see if they can't get that fire started again.
Well, I mean, it's surprising that somebody else hasn't stepped up to compete. You know, wrestling business is a huge, huge business that makes tons of money. And, you know, why somebody hasn't realized, hey, there's only one real major promotion out there and went, gosh, if we, you know, put some money into this. And, of course, you know, the problem with wrestling is you've got to put so much money into it, and then it takes so long for the money to get back out. You know, that's a real downside to opening up a wrestling company. That could be a detraction for a lot of people to do it. But, you know, take, for instance, Panda Energy. That's, you know, invested probably $20 million over the last couple of years, but this could be the break for them, and this could open the door to where they can make a lot of that back real quick.
You know, that kind of leads me to my next question as far as competition is concerned. There's been a lot of info coming out right now that the WWE's legal team is seeking a lot of cease and desist orders for a lot of trademark names, including Billy Kidman, Justin Credible, the Dudley Boys, Spike Dudley. Do you think that this hurts the competitors that carry those characters and names?
What do you mean?
Like, for example, do you think that, let's say, the artists formerly known as the Dudley Boys were to show up in TNA? Do you think them not being able to be called Bubba Ray and Devon would affect their overness with the crowd? Do you think they'd still be able to draw money that way? Or?
Well, I think it hurts NWA TNA's ability to properly exploit and promote the talent. You know, I don't think that it's going to affect once the audience gets to, you know, be reacquainted with Bubba and Devon. It's going to, you know, affect them being able to get over. They obviously know how to get over. But the problem is that you got to, you know, it's hard. That talent is being brought in to help substantiate NWA TNA. Well, how are you going to substantiate it when they're no longer being allowed to be called the very identity or, you know, it's like buying an iconic brand like Band-Aids. Well, you know, what good is it to, you know, try and do a commercial on Band-Aids when now you got to call them plastic strips?
Yeah.
You know, it's you've spent all this time and money and effort building the name of Band-Aid as for a product so that people will identify your product and will go right out when they need an adhesive strip for a cut. They go right out and they buy a Band-Aid. Well, now you're not allowed to call it a Band-Aid.
And now it's market branding, and now you're in trouble.
And now it screws it all up, you know. So what do you do when it comes to, you know, a wrestler? Well, the wrestler, I mean, that's one thing that no matter what people say, wrestlers that have been on WWE TV have a very established presence and name that lasts for a very long time. And, you know, Vince is being a businessman and making sure that they, you know, other people can't capitalize on it.
You know, the last time people have actually got a chance to see you on TV was at the ECW One Night Stand. I've got to ask you, what were your general feelings on that night?
I was happy to be there. It was like a, you know, big homecoming because I got to see all the ECW guys I haven't seen in a long time, and I got to see, you know, all the WWE guys I hadn't got to see for a while. So it was really cool just to hang out and get to see everybody. I was a little disappointed I get to have a larger factor in the show, especially, you know, considering I headlined, what, three or four of their pay-per-views, and then I was just, you know, pre-taped. But I understand that there's only so much time and only so many spots, and, you know, there were several matches I was supposed to be in, and then, you know, for one circumstance or another, it didn't happen. And, And so I was just happy that I got to at least do the pre-tape.
Now, what was your general feeling? I mean, you cut a promo, obviously in character, about the presence of the WWE Raw and SmackDown superstars, but do you feel that their presence hurt the product in any way, shape, or form of its authenticity at all?
Well, I don't think it hurt it. I don't necessarily know if it helped it, but, you know, the jury's still out on that, and everybody's going to have their own opinion, you know.
Well, one of the people you used to travel with, John Bradshaw Layfield, was involved in an incident with the Blue Meanie. What was the overall feelings towards that? I mean, did you see it at all, or?
Well, I didn't see it happen because I turned around and I saw Meanie all busted wide open. All I know is that I was in the ring and Meanie was directly behind me, and you know we were getting ready for the big confrontation, and I watched Bradshaw get in the ring and literally move himself down the ring and directly across from Meanie and I, and I thought he was eyeing me up at first, and I realized he was eyeing up Meanie. And then he and I went at it and just kind of worked with each other, and then I got pulled off. And next thing you know, after I got my head up, I looked around, and there's Meanie just bleeding. He's like, he was shooting on me.
That was a really rough situation to see. Caused a lot of speculation, and then Blue Meanie was brought onto television and was put over on JBL. Do you think that was good retribution for him, perhaps?
I would guess so. I guess, you know, that would only be an assumption on my part, since I'm not
actually there.
Yeah, not privy to it, and I didn't really get to talk to Meanie about it. So.
Now, another thing that's popping up right now, Hardcore Homecoming. What's your general thoughts on that? I mean, I understand you're under a WWE contract. You couldn't work for that, but is there... I mean, what's your general feeling of the show? Have you heard anything about it?
I haven't really heard a lot about it. I mean, I've heard that the last time, you know, it went really well and everybody enjoyed it. And I was really disappointed because, you know, I couldn't really at that time do it. But, God, it'd be great to be a part of it. I mean, who wouldn't want to?
Well, that leads to my next question. What's your current WWE status? I mean, are you able to do the part of their tour now if you wanted to?
I'm not under a booking contract any longer. With WWE, I'm a training consultant to OVW.
So if the opportunity was to present itself, say Shane Douglas was to contact you, there was a possibility that we could see Al Snow.
Absolutely.
At Hardcore Homecoming.
I would imagine.
Any possibility of that happening? No contacts, I'm assuming?
No, Shane had contacted me on the initial one and wanted me to be there, and unfortunately I couldn't, for, you know, contractual
obligations, yeah.
So it just couldn't do it at that time.
Well, Team 3D, Dudley Boys are going. It would be really something for people to see you there, which kind of leads us to the next question, is you run in ECW. I mean, you had some tough breaks in the WWE when you first came in as Avatar, Shinobi, then Leaf Cassidy as you were teamed with Marty Jannetty. And we're to understand that, you know, you were having some tough times. And
now with hindsight and experience, I can look back and, you know, some of those tough times I kind of made myself by, you know, just not even realizing, you know, inexperience and letting the frustration get to me and, you know, and not even realizing that every time you're on TV, no matter what it is you're doing, you're being given an opportunity to get yourself over. And you know, without that, if I'd only known then what I know now, it would have been a completely different situation, I think.
Well, you had the chance to reinvent yourself, which is something you advocate to anyone who's been released on the indie scene, to create yourself, create a new persona for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I knew at that time, when I was with WWF or WWE, whatever you want to call it, that if I stayed there, that I was either going to be eventually released, or I was just going to go fade away into obscurity because that was the spot I was in, and I could not, in that spot, change the powers that be, their perception. So I was not going to be used in a different manner. I was going to be given the opportunity as I was. It was going to be very tough, not to say it was impossible, but very tough to change that perception within WWE. So I knew I had to leave and go somewhere else and get myself over. So they could view me from the outside and look at it in a different manner. So, I begged Paulie to, at that time they had a working agreement with DCW and begged him to take me there. Chris Candido, a wonderful friend of mine, spoke up for me and helped me, you know, convince Paulie. And, you know, I went there and I got myself over through the grace of God and a plastic head. got myself over to the point where I knew that I had to, and that was to either have ECW pay to keep me, WCW pay to steal me, or WWE pay to get me back. And, you know, it worked. And, you know, when you're cut loose from WWE, it's not like it's the end of the world, and it's a lot tougher, that's for sure, because it's a lot, you know, it's a lot more comfortable situation with WWE. But, you know, it's a great opportunity for you to break out and go out there and recreate yourself and then come back at a completely better spot than what you were in the originally that you would have never gotten if you'd stayed there in the first place.
All of someone like Matt Hardy.
Matt Hardy, you know, I mean, you can go on down the list of guys, but this is giving them a chance to do exactly that.
Eddie Guerrero is a strong case for that.
Yeah.
Came back and he was, you know, second IC championship, and then all of a sudden he comes back, he's a world champion.
Yeah, you know, it just...
He's doing phenomenal. But one thing, I'm sure you're sick to death of telling this story, but, I mean, you made it look like so much fun, swinging that head with all the techno lights and everything going. How did you come up with the head gimmick?
Well, you know, I was back in the back. I'd been trying different things for quite some time on how to show that I basically had a nervous breakdown because I just used logical progression. I mean, for just the average wrestling fan, anybody that was as happy as I was, as Leaf Cassidy all the time, well, there had to have been something wrong with him. And for the hardcore fans who really knew my background, anybody that had been pursuing what I had been pursuing for as long as I've been pursuing it and having limited success as I did would eventually have a nervous breakdown. So I started reading books on abnormal psychology and trying to manifest a way of showing that in the ring, and nothing really clicked until one night, because at the bingo hall, you know, the other side of it, they build the Mummers Day parades. I went back there and was taking a picture with some Japanese people and with some great Sasuke and a couple other Japanese wrestlers, and I picked up a styrofoam head. And I remembered, like a year or so before, Sid Vicious and Bob Holly and Mick Foley and I were riding in a car in California. Mick kind of was horsing around with a styrofoam head that he had that carried his mask, and he was calling it a lane, and he was doing some, you know, acting like he was going to, you know, like sexual things with it. And just joking with it, and then I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to take this to the ring, and I'm going to talk to it and treat it like a living, breathing person. And there was in one of the abnormal psychology books, a little deeper answer than you thought, I would imagine, but in the abnormal psychology book, there was a case study about a woman who had, you know, was paranoid, schizophrenic, and had multiple personalities, but she had a transference disorder. What that means is that all of that illness she transfers onto an inanimate object and believes that she hears all the voices and the multiple personalities out of the inanimate object and believes it's sick, not her.
So you did your homework, what you're telling me.
Yeah, so that, you know, that's why I always referred to head in an asexual manner. I mean, it was not just a he or a she, it was a they. There were numerous personalities in there.
Now, one thing that head certainly did garner you was a lot of attention from the press. When Walmart decided not to carry your action figure because it condoned violence against women by claiming that you having a head in a briefcase was somehow offensive. What was your take on that whole experience?
Well, it was a boon, you know, a blessing. You know, any publicity is good publicity. It was ridiculous. It made me angry because it shows the state of the world today, and especially in this country, where the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Two women who were assistant professors of communications, of all things, at a college and should have known better, walked into a Walmart. Their kid wanted the action figure. They saw a woman's head, and it wasn't even a decapitated head where it had a bloody stump or anything. It was just a Barbie head that had been popped off, had "Help Me" written across it, showed me with a picture going, you know, acting crazy and all of it. And they just then assumed that it was a woman's head that I had cut off, that I carried around, and that promoted... and I quote, was a training manual for future spousal abusers. So, you know, they wrote the letter to the Atlanta Constitution, and because wrestling was so hot, the Atlanta Constitution, of course, printed it. Too sweet. And Walmart panicked because, God help, heaven forbid, if only two women express a concern, the way that the national media and national conglomerate corporations assume is, if two people were willing to take the time and effort to write a letter to a newspaper, then that means that thousands or millions more are of like opinion, just don't take the effort to write the letter. And so they panicked and pulled the thing from the shelves, which made me and the action figure a national news event for about, you know, a month.
It made also your action figure a hot commodity all over eBay and everywhere else. I mean, everyone was looking to get a hold of that action figure.
So nobody said anything about the following week. Literally the following week, they issued the Sleepy Hollow doll that Johnny Depp was in that movie with the headless horseman and two actual decapitated heads. You know, it reminds me of the Salem witch trials where somebody goes out and without doing any homework or any background checks, which these two women are professors of communication, of all things, for God's sakes, at a college, go out and expound their position, their opinion in a public forum without ever bothering to check into it.
Well, wrestling has been known for that, and it's become a spectacle in its own right. I mean, someone that has taken plenty of pot shots at you in his book, Mick Foley, actually has a whole chapter written towards the media and how it basically land-based wrestling. Like, for example, I believe it was that the individual in Florida that I believe he killed a little girl and they blamed it on wrestling.
Which is absolutely asinine.
Yes, it is, and it was blamed, and it was, you know, it just shows you that the media would love just to get their hands on anything that's just hype.
You have to remember about the media. The media is still entertainment. The news and the newspapers and they operate on one thing. Newspapers operate on selling newspapers, and the news media on TV operates on ratings. It's a business. It's just like anything else. And they need an audience, or they need to sell newspapers. Well, how do you do that? Well, you operate on emotions. What's the easiest emotion to get people to sit down and watch or sit down and buy a newspaper? Anger and fear. So, you always over-dramatize and create things. And granted, you're reporting the news, but you're doing it in such a manner that makes people want to buy a newspaper to read it.
What always gets me is that they can have a whole huge color printout of something and then put a little bit of bitty retraction about it later on.
That's what they're going to do. And, you know, keep in mind, if they would actually do their homework and go around and discuss these matters with, like, local hospitals and so on, they'd find more emergency room admissions for backyard injuries and such from general horseplay and from football and other normal sports, and none from where these backyard wrestling events take place.
Well, I mean, let's take a look at the media just in general. I mean, right around the 30th anniversary of Jaws, they kept talking about how many shark attacks are happening.
Of course, that's to get you to watch and get you to buy magazines.
Exactly.
Papers.
All hype.
And people just assume that just because it's on TV, that it's a completely unbiased and totally reliable source of information. And they base all of their opinions and their information needs on just that and that alone, because we as a society are too lazy to go out and get it ourselves.
Isn't that the truth? As we digress a little bit here, one of the things that, you know, still focusing on head, you came into the WWE, you were brought in after the blitz that you got in ECW. You had a huge fan following. In fact, you headlined a pay-per-view in the main event for the world title, if I'm not mistaken on that.
Yeah, I had headlined two pay-per-views. The first one as a, you know, secret partner for Lance Storm against Shane Douglas and
Chris Candido, that was...
Oh, and then secondly was, you know, for the world title with Shane Douglas.
Yeah, that actually one was, the secret partner was Living Dangerously,
yeah.
Back in 98. But when you came in, one of the people that really kind of gave you your first feud back to the WWE was Jerry the King Lawler, and you were involved in a tag match with him and Brian Christopher, and something I've always wondered about, your thoughts on Head losing that match for you.
That was a big mistake, you know, how are you going to get over and start building yourself up if you're going to already lose a match? And also with, you know, in a ridiculous situation where they pin it by sticking a bottle of shampoo of Head and Shoulders in the head so that, of course, now it has shoulders to pin. And you're basically making the gimmick into a joke. And, you know, again, hindsight's 20/20, and you don't realize things at the time, but, I you know, that didn't help at all.
Now, how did they approach you about that? They said, look, we got this great idea for you?
I have this great idea, and it'll be really funny, and, you know, And like I said, at the time, I didn't, you know, I didn't realize, and, you know, my job was to get over. And, you know, and if I failed to get over, that, you know, it wasn't gonna help me at all. And that wasn't going to help me get over.
Let's talk about getting over. The Job Squad. Who came up with the initial idea of the Job Squad? And if you can run it through us for us, the initial the pitch for the Job Squad.
I came up with the Job Squad the first time I was there in WWE. And the reason I did was because at that time we had all the gangs, on TV. Savio Vega had his gang, you know, had the biker gang, Undertaker, you know, it was just everybody had the different gangs. Well, they were starting to get their different gangs backstage. And, you know, people walking around and even had even said, you know, that they were making comments about, well, who's that guy think he is? Who's he ever beat? Well, that's a ridiculous statement in wrestling because he's beat the same people you have. Nobody. You don't beat anybody in wrestling because of the fact that it's a work. And you're working together, and the guy's only, you're only winning because the guy has agreed to lay down for you and do you a favor. So it kind of bothered me, and I was getting, you know, of course, at the time, I was kind of bitter and frustrated. And we were sitting there in the catering, and I told Jim Cornette, I told him I was going to start my own gang. And he just started laughing and asked me, you know, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I'm going to start the gang called the Job Squad. You know, wipe the mat with us. And he's like, oh, please, you're ridiculous. And I said, no, it's going to be me, Barry Horowitz, Chris Candido, you know. And I started, Aldo Montoya, listing off all the job guys. And he's like, oh, you know, what are you going to do? I said, well, let me explain something to you. I said, Undertaker goes out there and picks Barry Horowitz up, and Tombstone pile drives him, and Barry gets up off the mat, dusts his hair off, and walks out. Who was the most powerful guy in the ring that night?
Oh, that would have to be Barry.
Exactly. So, that's why Job Squad got started, was because so many people had forgotten just exactly what really is taking place in wrestling. And it was a statement. And when I went to ECW, I, you know, told guys they loved it, and it got to the point where we were, you know, everybody's like, oh, well, you got to make t-shirts, and one thing led to another, and I made the first, you know, t-shirt, which was Job Squad 1-2-3-4 Life, which was a joke on NWO, and on the back was Pin Me, Pay Me. You know, basically, you want to beat me? Fine, but you're going to pay me. You're not going to beat me and not, you know, not pay me for it. And then it just took off. People identified with it. People that weren't even wrestling. You know, I would get letters. I sold between end of March and the beginning of October, just at ECW shows and on the internet, I sold over 3,000 shirts. And I had like 5 or 6 different styles of shirts, and they became immensely popular. And guys would, you know, I'd get a letter from a guy who was ordering a shirt. And, you know, it would be, well, I work at this plant, and I put all my time in, I made all this effort, and I did all these overtime, and, you know, the boss's son got promoted instead of me. So I guess I'm part of the Job Squad. And so people really seemed to, you know, feel like they were getting jobbed out when they didn't even really know what being jobbed out meant. And everybody always asks me, what does J period, O period, B period squad mean? And I just said, well, it's the Job Squad. It's a secret organization. We fight the evil organization Push because none of us are getting one. So we started coming up with agent names for everybody and operative names, and that was it. It was a lot of fun. I signed a licensing agreement when I first came in with WWE because Vince Russo loved the idea and wanted to make, you know, an on-screen type of presence or character or gimmick. So he threw, you know, Bob Holly and Toots Gold Scorpio in there with me and Meany and
Goldberg was in it too, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was, you know, that was one of my, I loved the fact that, you know, I was able to help create that gimmick and get it on TV. So
you were the brainstorm behind Goldberg?
Goldberg, and you know, there were lots of things I'd given Russo ideas on you know, that he ended up using.
Do tell. I mean, anything that comes to the top of your head?
I helped with, like, The Brood with Edge and Christian and Gangrel. I forget now. There were a couple other ones I made suggestions to Russo about, and, you know, they ended up using them. So it was cool.
Now, one of your most memorable matches, and, you know, it kind of shocked people when, you know, this whole match took place, was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. You and Hardcore Holly for the vacant Hardcore title. That was February. You guys were in Tennessee, but you got to wrestle in the Mississippi River. How was that?
Very cold. Stupid. I was walking around and saw how close we were to the Mississippi River, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we went out here and ended up in the water? And that's what I decided to do. And, you know, I was, I didn't realize at the time that it was that deep, it was going to be that freaking cold, because as the day went on, I started reconsidering, because it was getting colder and colder, and that night, it was really cold. And Bob Holly was all cranked up anyways, damn near drowned me for real, so...
Now, if anything, what Tough Enough taught people is that Hardcore Holly is not just a gimmick. That's Bob Holly. That's Hardcore Holly.
Exactly.
And I think one of the things that's been remiss in the new Tough Enough is the fact that not only did this Tough Enough or the old format give a chance to develop the current stars that you were training and developing, but it also took away from the actual enhancement of certain characters like, let's say, Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle is arguably one of the best and greatest wrestlers in professional wrestling today. But him telling that story to the TV audience, not only to the TV audience, but to the Tough Enough people, about how he turned down a contract when he first came in, that kind of gave a lot of insight to his character and his persona. Did the current $2 million Tough Enough challenge people get a chance to meet some of the superstars that we weren't privy to?
No. Unfortunately, they didn't. You know, it was just not the same format, and you know, I think the regardless of what anybody says, you know, because they're detractors and stuff, they say whatever they want, but, I mean, it was, that former format, I think, did more to promote the business and promote wrestling and help promote the superstars, the existing superstars and future superstars, than anything else. It was a great, positive infomercial. I don't know how many people came up to me and say, well, you know, I've been a wrestling fan all my life, and God, I really, absolutely didn't realize how much you guys have to go through, and I really respect what you do even more now. And then there were just as many people that came up and say, I don't watch wrestling, but I watch your show, and, you know, I'm going to start, I've started watching wrestling because of your show. And they, you know, and they had a true respect for it, all because of it. And, you never really exposed the wrestling business.
Well, you know, there are three guys that really, more or less four guys that really kind of scared the bejesus out of both the Tough Enough viewers and the Tough Enough contestants. And they have to be, in no specific order, Triple H's promo on the first Tough Enough, Taz as a trainer in general, Bill DeMott, and Hardcore Holly. I think that really opened up a lot of the fans' eyes to the seriousness of the business. What was the overall off-camera response by the Tough Enough contestants?
Just exactly that. You know, everybody complains about, oh, we hate reality TV because, you know, it's not reality. But I can tell you, everything that you saw on the screen was what happened. I mean, all they did with Tough Enough was turned on the cameras. And, you know, in different cases, they would take the kids out or do this or do that to see if they could spark some interaction. But otherwise, you know, it was just, they were who they were, and I was who I was, and you know, wasn't enough, you know, and Taz was who he was, and it was all, nothing, none of it was manufactured for TV. Bill DeMott was who he was. I can promise you that. You can go and hang out with Bill DeMott, and you'll see he's exactly what he was on TV.
Now, one thing that has actually been, a lot of people have been questioning, Tori. What happened to Tori? I mean, she kind of fell off the face of the earth. I know promoters that were looking for her, and just everyone just kind of wonders, what happened to Tori?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
Okay, you're confused, too. The same thing happened with Mike Sharp. Everyone, no one knows what happened to him.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
He just disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Tough Enough helped you in a lot of different ways, but before Tough Enough, there was a lot of different things you were privy to, including gimmick matches, lest we forget Pepper. And the Hell in a Kennel match with the late Big Boss Man. How was that idea pitched to you? How was Pepper pitched to you? And then the whole match itself, what was that like?
It was, you know, it was pitched to me about, you know, Vince really loves this idea, and, you know, he really, you know, is behind it. And, you know, and it was just, it was an idea that, because Son of Sam, that Spike Lee movie was out, and I was, you know, it was going to be like, you know, I was hearing now, instead of the head talking to me, you know, the dog talked to me. And that was my relationship, and that's how I treated the dog, and it was my anchor to sanity and to the to this reality. And then when Boss Man, you know, took the dog, it wasn't just that he took my dog, he took my anchor away. And, you know, they had pitched the idea, and I told him at the time, I said, that's great, but you need a trained animal. And when you go and do the, you know, kennel of the hell, the kennel or whatever, you're going to need a trained animal there. You're going to need all of them to be a trained attack dogs, highly trained attack dogs. Because anybody in show business will tell you, one thing you don't want to screw with are animals and kids. And you know, just too many variables. And, you know, so that day I got there and walked around and asked people, you know, because I noticed they were all looking different and they didn't look like professional animal trainers. And did your animal have any training? Oh, well, one had some obedience training, and that was it. So they had made the entire focus of the story and the match the dogs. Well, now the dogs, you can't show them on TV because they're urinating, defecating, and fornicating so much that you can't even show them on TV. Well, then how can you work a match that the entire focus has been built around for months? Something that you can't even show or utilize. And so it became a big embarrassment.
And so was there any kind of, I guess, outright fear of being, you know, further attacked or being in danger once you actually saw what was happening in the ring? Or did you kind of ease up a little bit?
That was the whole point. You couldn't get the dogs to even act like they were going to attack you.
They couldn't even, like, you know, you guys were just shy of, like, kicking one of them and saying, hey,
right,
pay attention to us.
Right. Because they were so busy doing their own thing. The action from the dogs was when either they were going to the bathroom or they were doing each other, or when the big 350-pound owner was running out with his dog and tripped over the rug and big splashed his own dog.
The joy of live TV, you just never know what's going to happen. Although I guess they could have prepared just a little bit better.
But of course, you know, again, my mistake, I have to take the responsibility, at least partly, and say my mistake, because, you know, this business is always about taking shit and making shinola. And that was a case of having a lot of shit. But I had an opportunity, because every time you're out there, you have an opportunity to get yourself over. I could have still used it, you know, used that to get myself over and make shinola.
Well, in that situation, you had it both figuratively and literally.
Yes, I did.
Now, one of the other things that took place for you in your career was getting to tag team and become a tag team champion with Mankind, Mick Foley. How was that for you, I guess, personally and professionally?
Well, it was great. You know, we only got a week run, and I don't know why we only got the week run with it, but because I think that we really, you know, regardless of whatever goes on between Mick and I, we really have an on-air chemistry. And we can click and work together very well. But I don't know why it didn't ever go any further. So it was 1 week and then we were done.
Now on a radio station, Mick Foley said he was extremely close to signing with TNA before he decided to come back to WWE. I've got to ask you, how much of a coup do you think that would have been for TNA?
I think that it would have helped out tremendously, you know. And I think that's why Vince probably offered Mick enough money to not go.
And do you think it'd be properly used or just an expense to make sure competition doesn't get him?
Yeah.
A little both. Now, one of the things that after the Mankind situation, you were teamed with Steve Blackman. And
I'd asked to be teamed with Steve Blackman.
You asked to be?
Yes, because they weren't doing anything with me. Brian Gewirtz had an idea, which I wanted to do. At first, I told Vince that I wasn't comfortable with it, but then I got to realize, and I really wanted to do it, and then I couldn't convince Vince to do it anymore. And that was, at the time, I was, you know, again, crazy. So, Gewirtz was having me team with different people, different other teams. So it would be a six-man team. And I would, you know, team up with, you know, the Hollies, Bob and Crash against somebody else, and then during the match I'd turn against them. I'd crack one of them in the head and they'd lose the match. So I'd done that like 2 or 3 weeks, and eventually what that was going to happen was I was going to be in the ring and all of them were going to come out at one time and beat the hell out of me. And then I'd be off TV for a while and for a couple weeks, and you'd see vignettes, never showing me, but, you know, saying the swarm is coming, air raid siren, and you'd see tiny insects, you know, stinging a woodland creature, ants swarming all over somebody, you know, a locust decimating the field. And then finally, when one of the guys was in the ring, I'd come out, air raid with siren would hit, I'd point, and there'd be 20 to 30 midgets all dressed alike that would attack them. And I would be controlling an army of evil midgets called the Swarm. Well, it never took place, so I said, why don't you put me with Blackman? You know, his lack of personality, I will make a personality. And that was how it started. And to be honest with you, Blackman and I never really clicked in the ring because Blackman, you know, had his set way of doing things and couldn't think outside the box, which was very difficult. But in the ring, or outside the ring, he was the perfect straight man. I mean, we were, you know, when they would do the little minute-by-minute ratings, I mean, we started almost having our own little TV show with those vignettes every week.
So they were classic TV. And explain the head cheese gimmick. Where did they, I mean, he didn't seem too happy, and I'm sure that was the way it was.
No, actually, he was, you know, he's the one who had the head cheese thing because, you know, he was like, you know, head cheese, and he, you know, he knew that people would start chanting head cheese at him when he was in the ring.
Well, that's the beauty of professional wrestling. I mean, you're able to get the crowd to chant anything you want them to.
Right, because they want to be interactive and be part of the show. But he, you know, he was terrific as far as, you know, being able to, you know, work off of, and, you know, because he was so deadpan, just absolutely so deadpan that, you know, in some of the jokes he really truly didn't get, and it was made it even better.
Do you think that maybe in the slightest form that maybe the WWE lacks some of that humor? For the longest time, I mean, when it wasn't you and Mick Foley going back and forth, it was you and Steve Blackman. They had Edge and Christian doing the humor gimmick for a while there. They had Kurt Angle with Steve Austin. Do you think that maybe the current product lacks a little bit of humor, given yeah. with the exception of Eugene, maybe?
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, wrestling's like a three-ring circus. It's got to have something for everybody, and not everybody can be a badass. You know, if you have badass, 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 well, you've got 10 badasses on the show out of 10 bad matches. Well, you know, it's all vanilla. And even, you know, Baskin Robbins knows you need 31 flavors.
Now, one of the things that has been speculated or rumored about was that Nick Dinsmore has been asked to portray the Eugene character in public. Do you find any truth to that, and do you think that maybe that's...
I can't imagine. He's probably not been asked to portray it, but he does it on his own.
He does.
I'm sure he does, because it helps help the audience suspend their disbelief.
And how do you feel he's portraying that character?
He's probably just portraying himself, you know, just like he does in the ring.
He's one of the most talented workers out there, given, you know, his skill and working with this persona. But I dare ask the question, how long can a gimmick like this go? I know that, you know, it's back in the day, someone said, well, how long could a zombie be wrestling? And now look at The Undertaker almost 13 years later, and he's still hotter than anything. So I ask the question.
It's up to the particular talent.
It's up to the talent.
How learning the skill of how to get yourself over, then knowing the skill of how to keep yourself over, and then at some point, knowing how to get yourself back over. And that's exactly what Undertaker has done repeatedly.
Yeah, Undertaker, there's no doubt about it, has broken all barriers when it comes to professional wrestling. And, you know, speaking of professional wrestling, throughout your career, you've gone through so many ups, so many downs, different character changes. And now, out of nowhere almost, to the outside fan, you're the head trainer of Tough Enough. How did you step into the role of a trainer for any WWE school, be it OVW, Deep South, anywhere, but then to make it as the on-air head trainer of Tough Enough? How did that come about?
Well, I had already had a school for like 8 years prior, you know, for quite some time, and I know JR had known that, and several other people had known that within WWE. But Tough Enough originally was constructed or construed, you know, as a vehicle for Taz. you know, they thought that was what was going to really get him over. And it was never intended for me to get over. I was just placed in there because, one, I was one of those people they didn't have anything else to do. Two, you know, they felt that, you know, I could help out. And, you know, three, it was just, again, a place to put me. But, you know, I sat down and talked to Big, and, you know, we talked about the format, and I just basically told him the same format that I had used in my own training school because I had living quarters there and, you know, worked with them every day, and, you know, it was exactly the same format as what they wanted to do in Tough Enough, you know, getting everybody to live there to become wrestlers. And he loved it and took it, and, you know, and I never did it to get over. I treated that the way that I treat when I train these guys down here or when I train the guys at my own school, and that is approaching it with the way I was trained. When I broke in, there was not a proliferation of schools. It was a very closed business. In order to get trained, you had to convince somebody to take responsibility for you. Being able to, you know, to be willing to sacrifice or put at risk their livelihood and the way they feed their families based on your performance. Because once they trained you, they were now responsible for your success and your failure. And they certainly didn't want to have, you know, didn't want to put too much of a risk at that because they didn't trust you, because they didn't know you. So it was very hard to get in this business. And then it was very hard to stay in this business initially because they went out of their way because they weren't even the top guys weren't making anything near what the bottom guys are these days to make sure that you truly, absolutely, positively wanted to be in it for the right reasons, because they all knew that if you screwed up, it screwed it up for everybody. It ruined the business for everybody, and it ruined the way they fed their families. So I approached it the same way. The reason I called them my kids was not because it was a term of endearment, even though I did grow to care for them, but, you know, not like I was their father, but the guy that trained me, I was his kid. In wrestling business, that's how you were referred to. To this day, old-timers still refer to me as Jim Lancaster's kid. And if I screw up or do something on TV they don't like, guess who gets a phone call? He does. Still to this day after 23 years. And then I get a phone call from him. And that's, I personally believe that's the way it should be. I think that the degradation of this business is because of the fact that it is becoming far too easy to get in it. Anybody can go and buy themselves a ring, get a building, and then proclaim they're a trainer and train people and then just throw them on a show. Helter skelter, willy nilly, just people everywhere, you know, and nobody's held accountable for how these people work, perform in the ring, carry themselves, or behave outside of the ring. And I think that they should be held accountable.
Now, you may,
you know, not totally, don't get me wrong, like it's a Nazi state.
Yeah.
But at the same point, it should be, you know, they should take responsibility because it's their business.
Now, in Tough Enough, and it shows that you were the mentor for all these guys, and you were there for them, and you continue to be there. But my question remains to you: what is your general feeling and your emotional investment, you know, at stake for the releases that have taken place? Given Maven's been released now, Jackie Gaeta, previously Linda Miles. We also the only ones pretty much that remain from any Tough Enough season would be Chris Nowinski, who made it on his own valor, and let's say we have Johnny Nitro.
They all made it on their own valor.
Oh, I understand. I'm sorry. He came back after losing. He didn't win the competition.
No, and I knew that that was the case, and I knew that was what he was going to do. Back to what we had originally talked about, you know, being released from the WWE can be a blessing, or you know, can be a blessing. It can always. Doesn't always have to be the end of the world. And I guess it's just up to their individual situations to see which one of them is going to use it to their best advantage. And Linda Miles was never released. She quit. She just decided that wrestling was not for her.
Now, one person that was really upset and actually did make a big stink about it from Tough Enough Season 2 was Jake. Has anything come of Jake?
No, nothing has come of Jake. And, you know, and I... You know, the reason that Jake made it as far as he did in the competition was because, you know, he was an incredible physical specimen, an amazing athlete outside of the ring. And you know, he had a great look and he had an amazing amount of charisma, but he didn't have enough passion, and to be honest with you, he was about as smart as a bag of doorknobs. And, you know, great guy, really nice guy, but in this business, the most important thing you have to have is you've got to have a brain to be able to, you know, for the psychology and everything. And, you know, some, I don't care how athletic you are, some you can just get it and some you can't. And he, outside of the ring, was an amazing athlete. Inside the ring, it was like watching the Special Olympics. You know, and the reason that he, you know, everybody will say, well, then why was he kept on? Well, because you keep hoping that, you know, it might just click. It might just catch. And if it does, my God, this guy's going to make money. But it just never did. And, you know, Jackie was not the greatest in-ring performer. Linda was really good. Kenny at that time looked, you know, was just missing that certain something. Because he was really talented. So I knew that, you know, in this business, 70% of the time a girl's going to walk to the ring and back, and 30% of the time she's going to wrestle. So Jackie could be a marketable, viable entity in wrestling.
And she just signed with TNA, so we'll see what happens over there.
Yeah.
You know, one other thing that you made mention of about, you know, recreating yourself and doing it on Valor and just kind of sticking with it, two-part question. Number one is there anyone from the Million Dollar Tough Enough that is still pursuing actively a career in wrestling?
Yeah, a bunch of guys are because they're down in Deep South Wrestling.
They're down in Deep.
And that would be Ryan Reeves, Mike Mizanin, and Nick Mitchell.
From what I understand, the Miz, as he called himself, has been doing dark matches.
Yeah, he's been doing, you know, at the house shows and stuff with Chris Cage from OVW, they've been a tag team.
And another question I had to ask you about Matt Morgan. Matt Morgan didn't really get to go very far in the Tough Enough competition, but was given a chance to compete down in OVW. And then not more than a month later than he was brought up to the main roster, he was released. Do you think maybe it was just, you know, bad timing, or do you think there's still potential left in Matt Morgan?
Well, I think there's still potential in Matt Morgan. And again, it's given him an opportunity to go out there and get his own experience and be better off all the way around to where when he comes back, he'll be in an even better spot, in a better position.
Now, I understand Matt Capitelli injured himself about a month ago. How is he recovering?
He's coming along really well and is still a major factor in the OVW-TV.
Well, that's phenomenal because a lot of times when talent gets injured, they're usually put down and, you know, brought back when they're 100%, and the fact that he's still active speaks volumes for his character.
Well, he's doing what he can, and but he's doing really well, and Paulie's, using it as a platform to help Johnny Jeter turn heel and put some real steam on him, and, you know, it's really helping to freshen Johnny Jeter up and give him a whole new experience, and it's really good.
And how's the progression of the Boogeyman character coming along?
Well, it kind of got stalled a little bit because Marty had ran into some bad luck with a series of kind of injuries, you know, that just happened here and there. And, you know, he hyperextended his knees and a couple weeks back, and that kind of delayed things. So, but he's, you know, getting back to 100% and is, you know, feeling better, so he'll get back on track. He's, you know, they can say what they want about Marty. But Marty is a great performer. He's going to be a hell of a, you know, he'll make money if they give him another chance because he's got tons of charisma.
Now, one of the people that they were really kind of pushing and having a lot of hopes for was Kevin Fertig, and as they brought him in as Mordecai, and they brought him in for a feud with Undertaker, and that just didn't take off. Was he not ready? What was the circumstances behind the Mordecai?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know. Sometimes
things don't go.
I wasn't on SmackDown, and I wasn't down here in OVW at the time.
Ah, well, that makes sense then.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you, you know, a final question here is, where can the Knicks people get to see Al Snow?
Well, I'm, you know, working on Independence on a regular basis. And, in fact, on the 24th of September, I'll be in Peru, Illinois. And then on October 1st, I'll be in England. And let's see, October 29th, I'll be in Waynesboro, Virginia, taking on Maven. From what I understand, is a retirement match for Maven, which I didn't know. And, you know, and then I just got done doing a movie called They're Just My Friends. And it's a feature-length film. Just finished that last night in New York, filming that. So when it comes out, that'll be fun.
Have you confirmed that this is going to be Maven's last match? Have you tried to reach him yet?
I have yet to talk to him. I don't know yet.
Okay, because that's what's being, you know, reported as we spoke earlier today.
Yeah.
And hopefully that's not the case. I believe Maven has a lot of potential.
Oh, I do too. I think he could be a great star. I think Maven's a little frustrated and a little bitter at this time, and maybe he's needs to just take some time off and step back. You know, I don't know.
Well, if anyone would know anything about frustration, taking time off, and really finding themselves, it would be you. And I believe he's going to be in good hands. Although it has been rumored that he's looking to take his luck in Hollywood.
I think that he'd do very well there.
It would be an interesting progression for him as a person, from school teacher to professional wrestler to Hollywood actor. Way to go for him.
Yeah.
Well, Al, if you could just hold tight with us, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us tonight. And if there's any way that... is there any way that you'd like to have promoters get in contact with you, or would you have a medium?
Well, they can contact me at WWE Frosty, which is like Frosty the Snowman, at AOL.com, or they can contact Corey Phillips, who's at UpCloseAndPersonalBookings.com, or Michael O'Brien.
All right, well, there's several ways to get in hold of Al Snow. And I'd like to thank Al once again for joining us on the Gork Report Hotline. Al, if you just hold on 1 second, we'll be right with you. Callers, thank you very much for calling, and we'll see you again. Check out www.gerweck.net. Thanks for calling.